This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I was born almost half a century ago. Ensconced in the project of civilization. Without thinking, I switch on a light, drive my car, and shop at supermarkets that are ready 24 hours a day to satisfy my every need and impulse. With the spectre of industrial civilization now in the crosshairs of peak oil and climate change, I've become obsessed with the notion of collapse. From Joseph Tainter's Collapse of Complex Societies, Jared Diamond's Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail, to Michael Ruppert's movie Collapse, there is a growing pessimism about the ability of societies to adapt in time. There is even a term for individuals like myself, collapsitarians. In the fall of 2011, I spent 2 weeks living with Dr. Guy McPherson, author of Walking Away from Empire and Professor Emeritus from the University of Arizona.
This is the story of how the West was lost.
What's the answer?
The answer is to terminate the industrial economy as quickly as possible.
Dr. McPherson is focused on decoupling from the industrial monolith through relocalization. He introduced me to groups and individuals who are quietly preparing for just such contingencies. What comes to mind are bug-out bags and guns and ammo survivalists. However, much more powerful are the transition movements that are occurring spontaneously around the world.
That's a clip from the upcoming movie Somewhere in New Mexico, Before the End of Time, by Mike Sosaby. Our feature-length interview with the film's inspiration, Guy McPherson, is coming right up. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. It's beyond the point where a few doomer voices say our way of life is rotten, that industrial civilization may be driving straight towards catastrophe. Most of you and I, well, we can see the signs for ourselves. But we are addicted to fossil power. We slide daily back into that easy life. Why can't we change or at least walk away? Dr. Guy McPherson did just that. He left his position as a professor of natural resources and ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. Guy is now a focal point for people searching for survival, for transition, for a reality-based way of life. Guy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, I've been a fan of your blog, Nature Bats Last, for years. I almost made it to your experimental acres in the New Mexico hills. I was going to interview you at home, I thought, maybe as one of your tourists, but we ran out of time and gas money on the northern edge of Arizona. And, you know, it was over 100 degrees there, 38 degrees Celsius in the shade in early June. There was a huge coal plant busting out the energy nearby. So my first question for you, Guy, can Arizona survive without air conditioning?
That's a great question, and I suspect Arizona will be fine without air conditioning. I'm not so sure about Arizonans, though, especially the more recent version of Arizonans. In 1491, there were several hundred, maybe even a few thousand people living in Arizona and getting along just fine. But of course, we've pretty dramatically altered the landscape since then. So I think there's some tough days ahead for people who have come to rely upon air conditioning as part of their way of life.
And everybody does. I mean, people leave their cars and trucks running while they're in shopping because they want it to be cool enough to sit down without burning themselves. Well, look, suppose I made it to your retreat, let's call it, or to your acreage, and we're walking around. Take us on a radio tour. What will you show us?
Well, it's a good thing we have quite a bit of time, because there's a lot to see here. There are many gardens. Many of these gardens are what I call high-intensity beds. That means I excavated all the soil out of the ground, put in a basket of hardware cloth to keep the gophers from digging down and coming up into the garden, and then putting the soil back into the garden. So that's a huge amount of excavation, all done with a pick and shovel. Lots and lots of those beds, lots of beds that aren't so well protected from pocket gophers, but are protected from javelina, which is a native medium-sized mammal that lives here. Looks something like a pig, although it's not related to a pig or a hog. So we have four very large garden areas. We have an orchard with 100 or so fruit and nut trees in it. We have a chicken coop with 27 chickens, 24 laying hens, and some roosters. We have a goat shed that contains two milking does and currently four kids. We have a duck house that contains 14 ducks. That's where they come in at night. They spend all day outdoors foraging, as do the chickens. And currently we have three heirloom turkeys on the property that roost up in a tree at night. In addition, we have an off-grid straw bale house that's heated with passive solar. And we have an old 1995 double-wide mobile home on the property as well. It's used primarily for storage. So a few structures, a couple of solar wells that are driven by solar pumps, and rainwater harvesting off both roofs, off the double-wide mobile home and off of the now four-year-old straw bale house. In addition to that, there's a couple of greenhouses and a couple of cold frames and probably a half a dozen things I can't remember right now.
Where's the water for those wells coming from?
It's all groundwater. The static water level here is about 20 feet. We're relatively close to the last free-flowing river in the state of New Mexico. It's less than a quarter mile away as I look out my window. And so the static ground level of the water is about 20 feet down. So it doesn't require much energy to pull that water out of the ground.
And you've basically been describing water and food and shelter, and I know from previous interviews that I've heard of yours, you talk about the basic four needs. Do you want to list those out for us, and then maybe we'll talk about some of them?
Yeah, I think we need four things to thrive, and we need those things to thrive in any era, including currently, although most Americans in particular think we need a lot more things than that. The big four for me are clean water, healthy food, the ability to maintain body temperature, and development and maintenance of a decent human community. We're working pretty hard to secure all four of those elements here, and I think we've made pretty good progress over the last several years.
Okay, so let's start out with that question of maintaining body temperature. I think that's one of the biggies in our fossil fuel dependency. In the South, people need to keep cool enough. In the North, it's a matter of getting through the winter. And as far as I know, it's not really feasible to heat millions of homes in Chicago or Toronto with solar or wind power. So I have to wonder, can we really keep hundreds of millions of North Americans or Russians or Northern Europeans alive without fossil fuels?
It would surprise me very much if we could. I think we're deep into human population overshoot. We've been in human population overshoot since the first civilization arose several thousand years ago, as described by William Catton in his book Overshoot, which came out in 1980. So we've known about this for a while. We grow deeper into human population overshoot at the level of planet Earth by more than 200,000 people a day, each and every day. That's birth minus death. Are we going to be able to maintain that? I don't see any way we could. I don't see any way we want to keep ratcheting up the overshoot every day, given the consequences for the living planet on which we actually depend for our lives.
Well, you know, this is something that drives me crazy about news coverage, for example, of Japan. They say, well, the population is aging. It's not replacing itself. Oh, dear, this is terrible. It's awful. And I'm thinking, well, maybe they have a chance then because there will be fewer people living on that island. Maybe eventually they'll get to the point where the actual resources of the island could feed them and keep them warm.
Yes, absolutely. And ecologists have been writing about and speaking about limits to growth since ecology was created as a discipline. It's not that any of these ideas are new, but the politicians and the mainstream media, they're either untouchable or they are beyond the pale of the kinds of things we're willing to talk about. So, yes, let's stop the overshoot and let's try to learn to live on this planet, of which we have one.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Guy McPherson, the University of Arizona professor who left academia to find a more sustainable life. You can find his blog, Nature Bats Last, at guymcpherson.com. Guy, you had it nailed at the university. You were tenured with a pension and all the perks, including a lot of recognition for your books and your teaching. Why did you leave, and how did your academic peers react to that?
Yes, I did have it made. It was a pretty easy gig, and I was paid quite a bit of money. For the last several years at the university, though, I was pointing out the dark underbelly of industrial civilization. And it is difficult to point out that dark underbelly and live at the apex of empire. Tucson, Arizona is the apex of empire. Tucson transports its water uphill across the desert in open canals, 335 miles. Transports in all of its food, transports in all of its water, transports in all of its fossil fuels to keep it cool enough to survive in the summer, warm enough to survive in the winter, and on and on. It's increasingly challenging to point all that out and what the costs of that way of living include and continue to live that way and also look at yourself in the mirror. So I left because I think there's a moral imperative to the way we conduct our lives. And living in Tucson, Arizona didn't match that imperative for me. I left as an act of resistance, consistent with my baby boom generation of the 60s and 70s, in which it was resistance that got us out of the Vietnam War and gave us the environmental legislation that became the envy of the world and gave us the civil rights legislation that became the envy of the civilized world and so on. And it's only through acts of resistance that we secured all of benefit. And so I left as an act of resistance. In addition, I left because leaving gives me more latitude to speak and write about the things I think are really important, like maintaining a decent set of living arrangements between humans and the rest of the planet in light of energy decline and global climate change. So those are three primary reasons I left the university. How did my colleagues react? As if I'd jumped onto the crazy wagon for the most part. I have very little interaction with my former colleagues. I've been largely ostracized. There's a rumor going around that it spread beyond the university where I was employed to universities around the country. And the rumor goes that my insanity, which is a given, of course, can be explained by a rare brain disease. And so there's a story going around that, you know, scientists are always looking for the mechanism, always looking for the underlying cause. Apparently the cause of my insanity is this rare brain disease. I haven't heard it labeled yet, but that's the story I've been hearing out there in the rumor mills.
For some reason, this reminds me of that Doonesbury cartoon about Ronald Reagan's brain. I mean, it is this whole industrial system that has a brain disease. We make nuclear plants that blow up. We make emissions that change the whole climate. We poison everything around us, and we don't care about it. Who has the brain disease?
One of Derek Jensen's premises underlying his book, Endgame, is industrial civilization and most of its members are insane. And I think that's about right. And I don't see how you can reach any other conclusion besides that one when you take a look around. But, of course, insanity is defined by what is viewed as normal in society. And what I've done is not normal. What most of my friends and colleagues and acquaintances and pretty much everybody else living in this country is doing is the opposite of what I'm doing. And so if normal is what everybody else is doing, then it's pretty clear that I am the crazy one.
Well, and you've captured some of your experience in your latest book, Walking Away from Empire, A Personal Journey. We haven't talked about that word empire. What do you mean by that?
An empire is a civilized set of living arrangements that requires obedience at home and oppression abroad, and whole-scale destruction of the living planet on which we depend for our lives. So an example might be particularly helpful. Personally, I think the last decent man in the Oval Office was a guy named Jimmy Carter, who, through his daily actions, demonstrated some decency for other human beings and at least a compassion or a concern for soil loss and pollution and extinction of non-human species. And Jimmy Carter is known for the Carter Doctrine. The Carter Doctrine says that with respect to the Middle East, that's our oil over there. And by extension, all the world's, quote, resources are ours. Jimmy Carter, like Marcus Aurelius, was a thoughtful, wise, compassionate person who knew what it took to maintain an empire in decline. And so that means creating the world's largest killing force. Up until 1970, the United States didn't even have the world's largest military. The U.S. peaked in terms of oil production in 1970. And suddenly now we have a lethal force that is disproportionately huge compared to our human population in this country, compared to almost any metric you want to use. The number of people in this country, the number of people in the rest of the world, our geographical area, and so on. So if we're going to have an empire that depends upon resources from other places, oil and coal and food and so on, then we're going to have to get those somehow. And we can either write treaties, and we're not very good at that. The treaties that work out for us typically don't work out well for other countries. Or we can go get those resources at the point of a gun. And we're really, really good at that.
Well, you know, I don't just see this as an American empire. Sure, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of bases all over the world, but Canada has its own imperial activities. For example, we direct major mining companies all over the world that are quite destructive. And, of course, the European countries have not just that history of empire, but they have corporate activities all over the world. It's kind of an industrial megastructure, as I see it, where half the world's people live in endless poverty, while we take their resources or even their working lives and we chew up their atmosphere. What is the future of this industrial empire as you see it?
Well, first of all, I agree wholeheartedly that it's not just the United States that has created and maintains an imperial set of living arrangements. But come on, Alex, we're number one. There's not much question about that, is there?
America is number one.
It's a bunch of countries that are trying to do what we're so successful at, which is deriving everything we think we need at the point of the gun so that we can buy anything and do anything. What is the end game for that set of living arrangements? Well, we're driving some 200 species a day to extinction. That's one of the artifacts of imperialism. We are destroying so many aspects of the planet that we actually depend upon for our survival. Every year we wash more soil into the world's oceans. Every year we pollute more water, we foul more air, and so on. Those are among the consequences. We don't call it slavery anymore. We call it exploitation when we have people creating the cheap plastic crap we need for 2 days worth of happiness to be made in places like China and India and so on. And people are suffering and dying every day so that we can have Fritos and plastic toys that get played with for an hour or two. This is, all in all, it's difficult for me to imagine a more violent and horrific set of living arrangements. And yet, here we are, pushing for more, more, more. How does it end? Well, so far, it hasn't ended, and it keeps getting worse. Every year of my life has been worse than the year before. We've driven more species to extinction, we've dirtied more air, we've polluted more water, we've driven large carnivores off the cliff, and we've imprisoned and enslaved more people, and so on. I hope at some point we start seeing that turn around, that we see the world get better every year, that we see more carnivores next year than we saw last year, and more clean water and more clean air and less soil washed into the world's oceans, and so on and so forth. I think for that to happen, we're going to have to experience complete collapse of the industrial economy. I don't see anybody suggesting any other way that will get us to that point that actually scales at some large level. So for me, the first step was walking away from empire, which is analogous to, during the medieval period, people walking away from the king. Enough people do that, the king loses power. And so that's one step, but the next step is to start taking more action and more direct action in the spirit of Derek Jensen, for example, to terminate the set of living arrangements that is so horrific for people in non-industrial cultures and non-human species as well.
Well, now, Dr. Guy McPherson, you have expertise and have published books on both the environment and biology. Do you think the environmental situation is so serious that we should be thinking the possibility of extinction even for ourselves?
I not only think that we should be thinking about it, I think we've triggered extinction at our own hand as a result of climate change, or maybe as a result of environmental decay, or maybe as a result of nuclear catastrophe. We're pursuing each of those as rapidly as we can, and any of the three can lead to near-term human extinction. When I was editing a book on climate change 10 years ago now, I concluded that we probably were going to drive ourselves to extinction by 2030 because of climate change. About a year later, I discovered the notion of world peak oil. And I viewed it as a Hail Mary pass. Look, there's one thing that might terminate the industrial economy of the world and therefore give our species some hope of surviving beyond another couple of decades. But it's become pretty clear to me now that it's too late. Tim Garrett at the University of Utah wrote a paper that came out in Climatic Change in mid-November 2009. And in that paper, he concluded that only complete economic collapse prevents runaway greenhouse. That was 2.5 years ago, and the paper had been declined by several journals before it was published. So it was probably a few years in the making. I strongly suspect at this point that we've triggered so many positive feedbacks that extinction is baked into the cake for human beings. And that is a horrific and horrifically sad conclusion for me to reach, but I don't see much hope left in Pandora's jar.
Well, I used to believe energy depletion would take us down before the climate spun out of control, but now with gas fracking, the tar sands, we've got Arctic drilling ahead of us. I'm not so sure. What do you think?
I'm stunned at how long this system has persisted. And even though by any reasonable measure we're in the midst of an economic depression, we have still set records for greenhouse gas emissions each of the last 4 years. So 2011, we increased carbon emissions by 3.4% over 2010. 2010, we had increased 6.5% over 2009. 2009, we'd increased by 6.2% over the previous year, 2008, and so on. So climate change, it looks to me, is about as bad a Gatling gun as we could be possibly facing. And what are we doing about it? We're looking for more petrocarbons anywhere we can find them. And no matter what the cost, whether the cost is a completely destroyed Gulf of Mexico, whether it's drilling in the Arctic and releasing methane into the atmosphere, no matter the cost, we're willing to chase it down. If it means destroying all of Alberta and destroying all the clean water along the way, well, that's what it takes to maintain an empire, and in this case, it's a world empire, in decline. And so we're going to pursue that until we can't.
Well, we're some sort of meth addicts for fossil fuels. We will do anything, even though we can see that it's killing us. I find it very interesting that you mentioned Dr. Timothy Garrett. We did interview him twice on Radio EcoShock, and we had some great interviews with him where, indeed, as you say, he did scientific studies and calculations showing that just a complete collapse of our industrial economy was the only thing could save us from a climate catastrophe. Isn't it hard to call for the pain and suffering of what amounts to a super great depression, maybe unimaginable social dislocation, and say that's our best hope?
Yes, and so I don't do that lightly. But I balance that tremendous amount of suffering that will bring to industrialized humans. I balance that with the tremendous amount of suffering we're bringing to people currently. We are causing an enormous amount of suffering to the roughly half the people in the world who don't live in industrialized nations, such as the United States and Japan and Western Europe. And for that matter, we're bringing quite a bit of suffering to the folks in Japan right now, and Greece, the birthplace of Western civilization. And on the list goes. So I understand the concern, and I'm empathetic enough and compassionate enough to recognize the suffering ahead will be horrible. On the other hand, I'm empathetic enough and compassionate enough to recognize that the suffering going on every day right now is horrible. And I haven't even mentioned the non-human species within the last couple of minutes. We're bringing a horrible suffering to them as well. 200 species a day, that's genocide. This is not something we should be taking lightly. Albert Einstein said many years ago that 1 year without bees means the next year without humans. And colony collapse disorder is well underway. It appears that we're making a genuine effort to kill every non-industrial human species that we can find. And where does it end? Where do we decide the overshoot is too dire, the catastrophe from an environmental standpoint, including extinction, that's too dire? Where do we reach some sense of sanity to the whole situation and bring that to the table and say, okay, we're going to do something different and we're going to do it voluntarily? I don't know that we can get there voluntarily.
Yeah, you know, leaving the city, let's say, and going for a more self-reliant lifestyle, it's almost like choosing, for some people, for those of us who don't have a lot of money, it's like choosing voluntary peasanthood rather than participating in wrecking the world. Would you see it that way?
Absolutely. And there's a community a mile up the road from me that lives on a land trust, 13 people sharing 19 acres. The land was entrusted to the land trust as a gift. And they have a common well in the center of the property that's the only source of water. They carry water every day. They all live in off-grid housing, mostly houses they built themselves. And they could live in dire financial poverty anywhere in the country and perhaps anywhere in the world, but they choose to do that here. That they choose to do that is striking to most people I encounter. That they choose to do that here because this place is so beautiful, I think is quite the testimony to the people who occupy this particular part of the world. They're decent, compassionate human beings living in a beautiful place. So people can live in dire financial poverty and become largely independent of the industrial economy. And I see examples around me at every turn. It's not an impossible thing to pursue. It's not even a ridiculous thing to pursue.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.